May it please the court, Mr. Downey. In this case, respondent has engaged in significant professional misconduct by commingling personal funds with client funds in his trust account and by failing to follow the stringent requirements for safekeeping client property. He engaged in additional violations in his handling of a Title VII employment discrimination claim on behalf of his client, Margo Webster, by charging Ms. Webster an excessive fee, by failing to reasonably communicate with her, and by withdrawing from the attorney-client relationship under circumstances that were injurious to his client. The misconduct present in the case brings into focus the appropriate sanction for an attorney who has a lengthy and significant disciplinary history. Over the past 22 years, respondent has been the subject of 7 admonitions and 1 state suspension with probation. He received.
With 7 admonitions, why wasn't that graduated in some sense over the years?
Judge Tileman, I think that's a fair question. I do not know why at some point he didn't find himself before the court before there were 7 admonitions issued. The last one was issued in 2003. There were different types of violations. They cut across all spectrums of Rule 4. For some reason, the regional committee continued to admonish rather than filing
information. At that time, that was not uncommon in the 90s.
I'm not sure that, well, you know, to me, 7 admonitions is excessive. You shouldn't wait for 7 admonitions before an attorney finds himself before the court.
That was just saying historically.
It was, I will say that it was different, you know, it were different committees and different divisions of those committees that issued the admonitions, but that's really no excuse. I believe that 7 admonitions warrant someone being up before the court before you get this number 7.
On the record, I know I've sometimes been asked a lot of different questions, but Mr. Prouts has done an excellent job of putting the whole OCDC in good order.
Thank you, Judge.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Judge Tileman. In any event, the 7 admonitions cover a period from 1995 to 1996, 2000, 2003. The admonitions include misconduct for failing to reasonably communicate with a client, for incompetence, for a lack of diligence, mishandling client funds, and refusing to return a client file. 2 of the admonitions issued in 2000 involve violations of Rule 4-8.4C, cases in which the respondent engaged in dishonest and deceitful conduct towards his clients by, in one case, having them pose nude in his law office, and in the second case, asking them to pose nude in furtherance of his own interests. He was issued admonitions on those cases and accepted them. That's the point where I would have had him up before the court, frankly, in the year 2000 when he was issued those admonitions. Nevertheless, those are 7 admonitions that are issued. In 2007, information was filed and the respondent was put on probation with a state suspension by the court for multiple violations of the rules of professional conduct. In 2 of the cases arising from that charge, respondent charged a non-refundable minimum fee to perform legal services for a client and then withdrew from the representation without completing the work. Similar conduct to what occurred with Ms. Webster in this case. The respondent served that probationary period successfully, and it was lifted. The probation was terminated in 2008. The case before you today involves similar continuation of respondent's pattern of neglect towards his clients, as well as a troubling failure to safekeep his clients' funds. With regard to the trust account violations, the panel found and the evidence established by the OCDC established that on 3 occasions, respondent deposited personal funds into his client trust account, thereby commingling personal funds with client funds. On 7 occasions, he wrote checks out of his trust account to pay personal expenses using his funds, not his client's funds. There was no evidence during our audit of the respondent's trust account that he ever used client's funds, never misappropriated, never stole money. But nevertheless, he's commingled a serious violation. On 3 additional occasions, respondent failed to timely sweep or remove his own funds that were earned fees from the client trust account in a timely
fashion. Was there any selfish motive?
Selfish only in this regard, Judge. Respondent testified before the panel that part of his reason for using his trust account in the way he did was that it was easier and that he benefited personally if he could pay his business expenses with pre-tax money. So that was part of his explanation for the way he handled his trust account. It's not, in my view, deceitful, but it certainly is actions that are motivated by self-interest.
And no client was harmed.
Pardon me? No client was harmed as a result of the trust account violations. Not true with regard to Ms. Webster's representation. With regard to his other explanation was that he was told by his accountant that if he could keep his funds in his trust account and pay his expenses out of the trust account. Clearly bad advice, clearly not something he should have ever relied on. He's a lawyer, he knows Rule 4, or should know Rule 4, and the requirements of Rule 4-1.15. The Webster representation was a graduated type of representation. Ms. Webster actually entered into three contracts with the respondent over the course of a few years, and they all revolved around her deteriorating work conditions at the Office of the Collector of Revenue in the City of St. Louis. She felt that she was her job situation was deteriorating, and in the end, that she was retaliated against by her employer, by the City of St. Louis, as a result of filing an EEOC claim. She first goes to respondent as a result of a referral from BAMSL, their lawyer referral service in St. Louis, and she signs in 2002 a legal service contract with respondent to provide legal services regarding employment issues. In 2004, she signs a contract with respondent to provide legal services in connection with Title VII investigations, a Title VII investigation. In 2005, she signs a third contract, in each case paying a non-refundable minimum fee for legal services in connection with a Title VII federal district lawsuit. So by the time she signs that third contract, there's an agreement that there's going to be a lawsuit filed. In fact, no lawsuit does get filed. A respondent holds himself out as an expert in Title VII litigation, collects around $2,000 in fees from Ms. Webster, but in the end does not file that lawsuit, and when she comes to him with this additional evidence of retaliation, he ends up withdrawing from the case without ever filing the lawsuit. She does have enough sense to file a pro se complaint in federal court, and then has enough sense to file a pro se amended complaint, adding the retaliation claim. What she didn't know, and what respondent did know but didn't tell her, resulting in the 1.4 violation for communication, is that unless you take that retaliation claim back to the EEOC, it's going to get dismissed in the Eastern District of Missouri. And that's what happened to Ms. Webster's lawsuit. The case ends up being dismissed. The panel ends up recommending, after being presented with the safekeeping property violations as well as the representation misconduct with regard to Ms. Webster's representation, the panel recommends an 18-month actual suspension. The panel took particular note of respondents' extensive disciplinary history and observed the violations.
Why 18 months? That's sort of a different, we don't get those kind, a year, 6 months, 2 years. Why 18 months?
I don't know, Judge.
That's the panel. That was the panel.
It was the panel, you know, the chair of the panel was Doreen Dotson, a member of the advisory committee. She and the panel decided 18 months seemed appropriate. Clearly, though, the panel was disturbed by the fact that they have before them this extensive history. The panel made findings that the case that led to the probation in 2007 was the violations there were of the same nature as the violations.
Now, did he show records saying he earned that $2,000? Did he have records saying I put this number of hours in and that I she ran out of money because I'm not taking away from the point that he promised to file a litigation, but somehow he ran out of money. Did he show records that effect?
He certainly testified, I believe, before the panel that he had records to demonstrate that he had earned the charges that he assessed against Ms. Webster. He never brought those records before the panel. The panel made a note of that and basically found that he had violated 4-1.5 with regard to the fees by charging a fee for which he never earned, that he never carried out the objectives of that third contract, which was to file a Title VII federal lawsuit.
So now the DHP and the brief filed by your office indicates an 18-month suspension with no leave to reapply for 18 months. Is that how you feel today?
Correct. We believe that certainly we're supportive of the panel's 18-month recommendation. We certainly believe that an actual suspension is called for. Respondent in his brief cites the court 14 cases, trust account type cases, where this court has placed attorneys on probation. What I will tell the court, in my view, looking at those cases, is that none of those attorneys have a disciplinary history even close to what respondent's disciplinary history is. And in my view, a proper application of this court's decision in the Ehler case, where it supported the concept of graduated progressive discipline, this is a prime example of a case where that should be applied, and the respondent should be suspended for a period of time determined by the court. I will tell you that, you know, absent a disciplinary history that we have here, had he had no disciplinary history, I think I would have been supportive of state suspension with probation. I think that would be warranted. The trust account violations were certainly commingling, but no misappropriation. The representation of Ms. Webster was negligent in many ways and not diligent, did violate Rule 4-1.5 with regard to fees, 4-1.16 in terms of withdrawing in a way that was injurious to Ms. Webster. But it's that disciplinary history that, to me, sets this case apart from those other 14 cases or many other cases. Graduated now, discipline, in my view,
the disciplinary history, as Judge Stith indicated, there's been a history of, in the past, before you came aboard and have done a great job of cleaning up the backlog, there was a history of a backlog of cases and different kinds of outcomes, like you indicated, 7 admonitions and no graduation. Should we, in some way, discount the old history versus the more recent?
Sure, Judge. I totally understand the question, Judge Teilman. To me, the reason you don't, in many cases, we would come to you and say, well, a 22-year-old admonition, you ought to discount it. It's ancient history. What I think makes me not give an answer here is that these admonitions are interspersed throughout this 22-year period. He never goes more than a few years without getting an admonition. And in my, you know, we have one in 92, two in 92, then one in 95, one in 96, one in 2000, two in 2000, one in 2003, and then the probation case comes along. He is bumping along, violating the rules on a fairly constant basis. In my view, you don't discount those old admonitions because, frankly, during that entire period, he's never complied with the rules. And in my view, progressive discipline absolutely should be applied to the entire history.
Thank you, Counselor. You have time on rebuttal.
May it please the Court, distinguished counsel, Mr. Pratzel. You've heard a lot of cases today where people have agreed on things. This is not one of them. As indicated in the brief, we believe that a reprimand is appropriate or state suspension. And I'd like to get there. What I'd like to first of all talk about is the Webster case.
Are you familiar with any case where somebody's had prior 7 admonitions and a state suspension where they've just been given a reprimand?
The Wiles case, which actually cited in my brief and discussed, the lawyer there actually had 11 admonitions. In the Coleman case, I believe the lawyer had recently been reprimanded before he received a state suspension. One of the cases, actually, and I apologize, I didn't include this in the brief, but as I was listening to the Mandelbaum argument, where the court is asking for a state suspension, and if the court agreed, or I'm sorry, where the disciplinary counsel is asking, Mandelbaum would be one of those precedent. But I also thought of the In re Fork case, which was decided by this court in February of this year, where the lawyer was actually on probation and committed a further violation of rules and received an extension of his violation. I do think there's precedent here. And I think part of the way that we reach that is there's a fundamental disagreement regarding the Webster case. And I think if I can explain that, I think you'll see this really is a trust account only case, and the violations here do not rise to the level where a suspension is appropriate. So turning to the Webster case, contrary to the arguments that were made by disciplinary counsel, this is not a new case. The representation of Ms. Webster stretched from 2002 until 2005. So the representation was over before the probation order was entered. The case was stale when the client finally came forward in 2009 or 2010 and filed her complaint. Her complaint, as indicated, basically was that the lawyer had not helped her file a lawsuit. The record is full. I know often lawyers come before this court and say, I told my client to do something, and there's no evidence. Here there are multiple letters, one from April of 2005, one from May of 2005, and two from June of 2005, where Mr. Swimmer said to Ms. Webster, I'm not handling your case. You need to get me a retainer. You need to get me your homework, which was a half page of questions answered. She did not do so. By her own testimony, she came in on what was apparently the 87th day after the right to sue order had been issued. And by her own testimony, Mr. Swimmer told her, I'm too busy, go file your own lawsuit, which she did. So he did not take on the representation of a lawsuit. Subsequently, as indicated, she was disciplined at work. She was terminated at work at a time when she agreed Mr. Swimmer was not helping her on the case, and she also said she was not testifying with him. This would be a case where if you impose discipline, based upon his handling of the Webster case, we would be disciplining a lawyer for not properly representing a client who had never satisfied the conditions of being represented, she had never paid the filing fee, and she had never actually given him the homework until the last second. And
did he take $2,000 from her for that?
He took, there were three payments made. In 2002, he said, I will write a letter for you for $450 or $550.
Must have been a really good letter.
Well, if you think about it, you know, that's 2 hours of work, perhaps. He actually was paid half of that. He did receive it. He wrote the letter. In 2003, she came back. She asked him to help on the EEOC investigation. He asked for $550. She paid him nothing. There was some disagreement regarding the work that was done. In 2005, she came back and said, I want you to file the lawsuit. He said it would be a $1,000 retainer, and admittedly used the terms non-refundable retainer, which this court had not, the ethics opinion had not yet said should not be used, and in fact his probation had said should not be used. She paid the $1,000 ultimately. She actually paid a $50 penalty because she kept skipping meetings with him. At the end of the case, he did retain the $1,300 he had been paid between 2002 and 2005.
How did that relate to the time period, the 87 days, and when she needed to file suit?
Those payments were made during the period, and Mr. Swimmer's testimony was, I had spent more, the agreement was that she would pay a $1,000 retainer, and I believe his hourly rate was $225 an hour. And he testified and said that by the time I had ended up not representing her, I had already spent only 4 hours on
the case. So he took the $1,000 and then told her, I'm too busy, go file it yourself?
That's correct.
Do you think that's an appropriate way to treat a client?
Do
you have an obligation to look at statute of limitations and other kind of limitations periods if you're no longer going to continue representation and advise the client about those? Before you simply quit representing them?
Mr. Swimmer's testimony was that between the issuance of the right to sue letter in March of 2005 and June of 2005 when the deadline came, he did research on the case and talked to her and had communications with her, and he said he had earned the fee. If he had called me and said, you know, perhaps should I refund it, I said, it will probably save you a headache.
I'm asking about, he took her money, she was his client, they had an attorney-client relationship for the purpose of filing suit, and 3 days before the 90-day period within which she can file runs, he says, go do it yourself, I'm too busy to take care of you. And that's not sanctionable conduct, you don't think?
I'm not saying it's appropriate conduct. I'm not saying it, but I will say it, I don't think it rises to the penalty here. What his testimony was that he had told her he would work on her case, he did work on her case, and he deemed that he had earned the $1,000 in the time between March and June. And that was what his testimony was.
Did he ever advise her of how much a case in federal court on discrimination would actually cost total?
I don't believe there's testimony in the record, but he has indicated to me that he did, yes. So that's outside the record. And let me just also say,
I mean, 1,000 here and 500 there, I mean, you're filing a case in federal court, that's a that costs a lot of money to actually represent someone.
Absolutely, and certainly.
And of course you hope for attorney's fees. Title VII would provide attorney's fees for the successful plaintiff.
Yes. In addition to which, representing someone from 2002 to 2005 through an investigation, et cetera, would normally cost more than $1,300, right, which is what it cost here.
What's in the record regarding her not being compliant with getting him the information he needed in order to have time to file suit?
There are these multiple letters. In fact, his June 21st letter, I said, I need your homework back tomorrow, if not sooner. She was very aware of it. She testified she knew she had to get the homework done. She testified she knew she came in on June 27th, unannounced, without an appointment, and said, I've got my homework. And that's when he said, I don't have time to file your suit. And an important thing also to realize here was this is in June of 2005. If she felt she was really out the $1,000, she waited 5 years to raise it. She never wrote him a letter. She never complained. She never asked for the money back. In 2005, she filed this disciplinary complaint, and that's where we are today.
There's no statute of limitations on these complaints.
There is a statute of limitations of 5 years, but it's only for the disciplinary counsel if the disciplinary counsel knew or had reason to know. And
but
there's no indication they knew.
The question is not, is $1,000 unreasonable for the work he did, but unless he limited, did he enter into a contract for limited scope representation? Because otherwise he undertook to represent her to file the suit and then didn't do so. He would have had a basis to charge more is a different issue than whether he could simply terminate the relationship at that point without any further obligation.
There were two prior engagement letters, both of which are in the record from 2002 and 2003. Both of them provided that Mr. Swimmer would do work and charge on hourly fees. The 2005 engagement specifically required her to do certain things, before that engagement commenced. And she, among other things, she never tendered him the filing fee, so she never actually satisfied all the conditions. I mean, I would say that I don't think the 2005 agreement ever came into effect, because he said, you have to do three things before I'll file your lawsuit. And by her own testimony, she did one of them at the last minute and never did the third one.
And so what, on what basis did he keep the fee then?
He indicated that he had spent more than 4 hours.
No, I understand, but yes. You said they didn't have an attorney-client relationship?
They had several, I mean, they had at least two attorney-client relationships, one for earlier in the case. What I would say, Judge, is if someone came to me and said, I'll do some preliminary work on your case, but I'm not going to file it unless you pay me a $1,000 retainer, Mr. Swimmer's position was that he was entitled to keep the money because he had done that preliminary work, and the preliminary work amounted to more than the $1,000 worth of legal services. So he would say that was actually earned. What he would say was that...
What is your evidence that their attorney-client relationship ended where he did not enter into a limited scope representation agreement?
He told her, I don't have time to file your lawsuit. She understood that he was not filing her lawsuit. She filed the lawsuit pro se. She prosecuted it pro se. He never filed a pleading in that lawsuit. I mean, they were done. She never talked to him again until after she had been terminated and after she had filed the second amended complaint. By her own conduct, she showed she knew it was over. And there's a question of whether or not he should have returned some or all of the $1,000. What I think is interesting is 5 years later, she doesn't really even raise that in her complaint.
Are you saying at the time the retaliation occurred, which is after she filed the suit, they no longer had a relationship and she didn't think they had one?
She knew they did not. That is correct.
How long after this 87th day was that?
The lawsuit was filed, I think, on the 87th or 88th day. She was suspended from work in July, and she was terminated in August. So
which
basically,
about
40 days later.
Okay. And she had no contact with him at that point?
She had no contact with him until after August 20th, so almost 2 months later.
The June contract where she retained him to act as legal counsel in connection with the federal district lawsuit.
Correct.
That's the third engagement letter, right?
That is the third engagement letter, yes.
And it's your contention that that was subject to conditions subsequent, or why didn't that?
My understanding would be conditions precedent, that he had said, you need to pay me the $1,000 retainer, you need to advance me the $350 fee, and you need to provide me with answers to the homework, which is the very next page of the record. I see you're looking at the record. Mm-hmm. The important thing to realize here for the court is that if she doesn't provide him with the homework, he doesn't have what he needs to file the lawsuit. So what do we say to the lawyer? Well, on the 87th day, you should have filed something without doing your own investigation, or you should have filed it on the 85th day without the client indicating they're going to pay you and without knowing really the facts of the case. I mean, we're putting a lawyer in a trick box if we hold him liable for this. He said you need to do three things. She's testified she never did one of them. She testified she did the other one at the last minute, and he said, I'm sorry, it's too late. He had written her four letters saying, I need this right away. She testified and said, I know I need to do this right away. She didn't do it right away. I mean, Ms. Webster, it's the client's problem.
And there's
well,
no reason.
Well, the problem here is that there's the agreement on the 5th that doesn't have any of those contingencies in it. And then 3 days later, he writes her a letter and he says, I have to have the $1,000 in the filing fee in order to lodge your lawsuit, and on and on. He doesn't say that I'm not representing you until I have this stuff.
Actually, I believe the engagement letters you're looking at was signed in June of 2005. It was actually tendered to her several months earlier, I believe in April, with the initial set of questions, and there were indications at that point that he needed those three things. So the terms of this agreement were actually set right after the right to sue letter was received in March of 2005.
But you would agree that the engagement letter itself doesn't have those contingencies in it?
I believe that's correct.
Now, what should be given to the historic admonitions and the other discipline that was leveled against Mr. Swimmer over the years?
As counsel for a respondent, I'd love it to be zero. I think the reality of this court is that it will be given some weight. What I would say is that when you remove the Webster case, which I think should be removed, because he at most what he did there was he should have refunded some of the fee and didn't, but she never really even raised that issue. So what I would say is this really is a trust account case. What you have is you have a lawyer who in 2007 was put on probation. He successfully completed it. He paid his own law practice consultant, Sarah Reed, to help him run his practice properly. She came in, he thought he had fixed things, and he really sees, I turned things around with that 2007 through 2009 with a law practice consultant. the case here, what it was a overdraft based upon a client's balance check. Admittedly, he didn't wait for the funds to become good. So when he paid BAMSL the referral fee, it was an overdraft. They looked at a year's worth of records for him. They didn't find him taking client money. They didn't find him mishandling things in a lot of ways that you hear. He apparently had appropriate records. What he did admit to doing, as Mr. Pratzel indicated, was he was paying business expenses from his own funds, which he was leaving in the trust account. Now, interestingly enough, he was charged with violating Rule 4-1.15C and E. 4-1.15C requires you to set up a trust account and keep funds separate, which he was doing. 4-1.15E is that you're not supposed to deposit your own funds in. When Ms. Dillon, the paralegal for the OCDC, testified about you should sweep the funds out, I asked her the question. I said, what portion of the 2012 rule, not the current rule, but the 2012 rule made that clear? And she looked at the rule. She thumbed through it. And you may recall the rule is quite long and quite arcane. She settled on 1.15J, which actually starts off and says, if the parties are in dispute regarding the handling of funds, the disputed funds should be held. And then it goes on to say, all funds that are not disputed should be promptly paid out. And I think it's reasonable to say that's not even really clear. I think the new rule makes it clear. I think what you have here is a lawyer.
Well, the old rule referred us to the ABA standards for trust accounts, which required that. The new rule just incorporates that directly into the rule instead of saying you're bound by these ABA ones.
Yes.
So it was all there, but you just had to go look elsewhere.
And I think the important tough thing, I noticed in looking at the informant's brief, they don't cite a single disciplinary case after 2006, other than the Eller case, which has been talked about already. What I think is interesting is we have, as has been talked about before in this court, we handle trust account cases differently. This was not a case where a client complained. This was an overdraft. It was an overdraft, frankly, on the scale of things, I would say a pretty innocent one, a lawyer who too quickly paid a referral fee to BAMSL.
Now, Mr. Swimmer is being obviously represented by excellent counsel and you. You do an excellent job when you come here and represent your clients. But prior to that, did he think of going to Sarah Rittman or the counsel for the bar and saying, gee, I'm thinking about doing this, I guess get an interpretation or get some advice? The bar and the OCDC set up this mechanism. Now, Sarah Rittman was there before as a woman, I think, frankly, now, set up this mechanism so you could say, well, I don't know what the rule says or how to do it. How would you think we should do it?
He did actually two things along that line. The first is that from 2007 to 2009, or 2010, he paid Ms. Reed to consult with him on his law practice at his own. He did that on his own. It was not part of his probation order. The second thing that he did was he also, his accountant was not only an accountant but also a lawyer who, frankly, gave bad advice. And, you know, we are here today. We have not named that person. We've not called them as a witness because, frankly, we don't want them to get in hot water. We don't think it's a reportable offense. We don't think there was any fraud, deceit, or anything calls into question of competency. But it's a situation where he received advice from a lawyer who he thought knew what they were doing, and it was a bad decision.
Other questions? Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you. We again ask, we believe that the cases cited make a reprimand or state suspension appropriate. We ask that the court enter that. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to ask the court please to focus on the trust account violation, first of all. We'll talk about Webster in a moment, but the panel itself found that the Webster representation only warranted a reprimand. What the panel found at page 433 of the appendix in their decision is that the trust account violation was much more egregious. And commingling of funds, maybe you're not misappropriating, maybe you're not stealing, but commingling is a serious violation of the rules and rule of safekeeping property rules. Also, given the fact that we have two prior admonitions in 95 and 96, at the appendix is pages 382 and 384, where he was already admonished for violating the safekeeping property rules. So he was already told, don't do this, and did it again.
All this happened 9 years ago, though, right? And stopped 9 years ago? When were the trust account violation?
The trust account violation was reported to us that the overdraft occurred in March of 2012.
Okay.
As a result of a payment he made to BAMSL on a referral case that bounced. Ms. Webster didn't report that to us until October of 2011, and so we just didn't know about it until then. Mr. Downing's correct. It did predate, the misconduct did predate the probation. Nevertheless, We have conduct here that sequentially occurred, namely the trust account violation, after all these other disciplinary actions had been taken.
Can you address in the Webster case? He says the retaliation claim didn't arise until after he was no longer representing her and therefore would have no obligation.
I think if you look at the record, our brief, the record in the DHP decision, you will come to a different conclusion. The fact is that she was repeatedly contacting him about her deteriorating work conditions for the city, claiming that they were retaliating as a result of the EEOC claim. And the fact is, what I don't understand in respondents' argument is we have a contract that's signed in June of 2005. She complies with everything she needs to do. She pays the $1,000 3 days before the statute's going to run. She fills out this homework in advance, but he's too bothered and says, I'm too busy. Go do it yourself. The contract that was signed in June of 2005 provided for legal services in connection with a Title VII federal district court lawsuit. He did not carry out that representation, the objectives of it, but he did collect the fee for that third contract.
So you think it's unreasonable?
You said she filled out the homework. He says she didn't fill out the homework.
She did, in our view, everything, and the panel found, if you look at paragraphs 35 and 37 of the panel's decision at pages 428 and 429 of the appendix, you will find that the panel noted that she did everything she had to do prior to the running of the statute for him to at least file the lawsuit.
At the last minute.
At the last minute, but lawyers get asked to do things at the last minute. They don't get all fed up with that client and say, go do it yourself, and I'm not giving you back your non-refundable fee, by the way. That clearly violated 1.5 and 1.16.
What was the evidence? Was there evidence regarding what he had going on at that time that he told her he did not have the time when she waited until 3 days?
I'm not aware, Judge Breckenridge, of anything in the record. There may be something there. I just don't know about it. But perhaps.
Because he had a letter in the record on June the 8th telling her, I needed that information yesterday or sooner. And so she didn't get it to him for another 19 days.
No doubt that, you know, she's not faultless here, but she's not the attorney. She's not the one that collected the fee to get a job done before the statute ran. So what she left with, she's left with an attorney that says, even though you got me what you need to get, it was late, it was last minute, I'm still keeping your fee, but I'm not carrying out the representation. To me, that is a clear violation of that contract and the rules. But again, remember, that to me, the most serious and most egregious misconduct here is that commingling in the trust account case.
And normally that would, you'd recommend a state suspension for that, but because of progressive discipline or?
Absolutely. The point is that, yes, it's egregious, but if we had an attorney with no disciplinary history, no prior violations of 1.15 safekeeping property, I would have absolutely said, let's put him on probation and monitor him for a couple years. But that's not the case here. This attorney's had so many chances to
comply.
What
about the advice he got from his accountant?
That's meaningless. So that you have an accountant telling you can do something that you should know better, and you've already been admonished for violating the safekeeping property rule. Then you get told something that maybe I'm going to take the benefit of it because I'm going to be able to use pre-tax dollars. So I'm going to listen to my accountant, and I'll blame the accountant. That to me doesn't wash before this court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken as submitted.